It was in 1993, beloved listeners, as part of the Oslo Peace Accords, that the Israeli government and the PLO set out a process for a mutually negotiated two-state solution to be implemented by the end of that decade. Fast forward 27 years and Trump's recent peace plan for the Middle East is well and truly making a parody of what Palestinians thought decades ago could be theirs. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has the power to bring a vote to the Knesset to decide whether to annex up to 30% more of the West Bank. Now, regular listeners will recall I spoke over a week ago to Peter Barnard, a long-time supporter of the two-state solution, who is now arguing instead for one democratic state for all Jewish and Palestinian inhabitants. My next guest and his family have been present from the very beginning of the Palestinian struggle. Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies in the Department of History at Columbia. He's the author of 10 books on Palestinian history. His latest, The 100-Year War on Palestine, a history of settler colonialism and resistance. It's published by Allen and Unwin, and he joins us now from the US. For you, Rashid, this history is so personal. As far back as 1899, your great-great-great-uncle Yusuf al-Khalidi told the father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, and I quote, "In the name of God, let Palestine be left alone." And this was, of course, well before World War II.
Right, exactly. The book starts, in fact, with that anecdote about a letter that my great-great-great-uncle sent to Theodor Herzl, sympathizing in principle with Zionism, but warning them that in principle it would not work, that this was a country that was inhabited by a people that would not agree to be supplanted. And he ended with the phrase that you just quoted, "For the sake of God, leave Palestine alone."
And his reply told al-Khalidi, then the mayor of Jerusalem, that in effect Palestinians' indigenous population did not matter and would anyway benefit from the modernizing effects of Jewish pioneers like America. God, that's a familiar theme, isn't it?
Well, for Australians and Americans, it's a very familiar theme. The white man's burden, the civilizational impulse of colonization. I mean, these are tropes that should be familiar to Australians and Americans, because both of our national projects started out as settler colonial endeavors. He was very prescient, but I think that he still had the hope that he could reach Herzl. I think Herzl's reply may have disabused him of that hope, and it is symptomatic of the kinds of brush-offs that the Palestinians received, whether from leaders of the Zionist movement or later leaders of the State of Israel, or for that matter, from the British colonial authorities, and much later from American diplomats right up to the Trump administration. Palestinians, none of them paid serious attention to what the Palestinians had to say. None of them have done, right up to the present. That's certainly true with Trump.
From 1917, aided by Britain, Jewish settlers began to colonize Palestine. And as you point out, this was never a clash between two national movements in an equal contest.
Exactly. I mean, eventually both became national movements, but the point that you're making is really very important. There's this illusion that the two peoples are somehow on a footing of equality. The greatest imperial power in modern history, which is the British Empire, was solidly behind the Zionist movement. It could not have implanted itself as it did in the decades up to World War II, were it not for British bayonets, were it not for British repression, were it not for British support of various kinds. And
well,
the same
well,
has been
let's,
true
let's,
ever since World
let's
War II.
Remind the listener of what Balfour, dear old Arthur of the Balfour Declaration, had to say at the time. Zionism, be it right or wrong, is of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land. Hardly fair and balanced, to quote from Rupert Murdoch.
Not at all. Not at all. And indeed, I think that the quote that you just gave our listeners sums it up neatly. Balfour was perfectly aware that there were only a few thousand Jews in Palestine, maybe 5% of the population, 50 or 60,000, and that there were 700,000 Arabs. The Arabs were just not important. And that's in keeping, again, with the tone of Herzl's letter. And it's in keeping with international resolutions pushed through, whether by the British in the League of Nations or the United States and the Soviet Union in the UN in 1947, which again and again, in effect, take the side of the settlers, of the Zionist movement, and later of the State of Israel.
Now, in 2020, Trump's long-awaited deal was finalized, and this will come as a shock to the most hardened skeptic, was finalized without any consultation with Palestinians.
Well, that has actually been that has again been a pattern. I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation that went to the Madrid peace talks and then continued with negotiations in Washington with the Israelis. And one of the things I learned as a historian much later was that everything the United States did in terms of presentations to this and other peace conferences and other aspects of the peace process was cleared beforehand with the Israelis. So we're really talking about an American-Israeli position rather than an Israeli position backed by the Americans. And in the book, I go through different phases since 1947, 48, when this was the case, where the United States not only took the side of Israel, but was in fact colluding with Israel. And this has particularly been the case since the 1970s, 60s and 70s.
Rashid, the Palestinians have not found their own Mahatma Gandhi or a Michael Collins, but you argue that in spite of this, they are far from defeated.
Well, this is true. If one thinks of this as a settler colonial struggle, it's not a struggle between two. It is a struggle between two peoples, but it is also a settler colonial struggle, just like what occurred in, I repeat, Australia, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, but also in Algeria, Kenya, and South Africa. And there are different outcomes to this. One of the things that the Palestinians have shown by their perseverance and their resistance is that it was impossible to do what Herzl in his diaries once said, which is to spirit the entire population or the poor population across the frontiers, in other words, to get rid of them. There are more Arabs in the area of greater Israel between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean than there are Israeli Jews. And this is remarkable given the odds against the Palestinians from the very beginning of this, of what I call a war on Palestine.
Now, Trump took Jerusalem off the table, Rashid. He recognized it as Israel's capital, which was a monumental departure from 70 years of U.S. policy, and giving it that recognition was in defiance of the 1947 UN resolution that called for the partition of Palestine into Arab and Jewish states. Is this something that could ever be reversed?
Well, in fact, Israel has often done as it pleased with the entire international community, with almost no exceptions, condemning what it does. If the United States changes its position, we would be right back where we were before this happened, i.e. Israel would do as it pleases, which it has done again and again and again in defiance of international law and the UN Security Council, but it would be completely isolated on the issue. So it cannot be reversed in the sense that unless coercive measures are taken against Israel, unless there's some cost for Israeli defiance of international law and of Security Council resolutions. And this the United States has consistently refused to do, even where it verbally condemns an Israeli action, as it has by supporting a variety of UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israeli annexation of Jerusalem in the past. It has done nothing to force Israel to cough up areas that it's taken or to stop its human rights abuses against Palestinians. That would require sanctions of some sort.
Back in 2017, in an article in The New Yorker, you predicted that under a Trump presidency, Israel and its new American soulmates would call the tune in Palestine for at least the next several years. It's now 2020. Is the two-state solution officially dead?
Well, I think that what Trump has done has kicked it even deeper into its grave. It has taken down some of the masks and some of the disguises that what really amounted to rolling annexation and Israeli control of the entirety of Palestine, which was and is ongoing, and makes it clear that it is not possible, given what Israel has done and the United States has financed and defended over since 1967, over the 53 years since the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in Jerusalem, such that I think in a backhanded way, the Trump administration has done us a favor. They've made it clear that nobody in his right mind in the Trump administration believes that the Palestinians will have sovereignty, that the Palestinians will have security control, that the Palestinians will control the water beneath their feet or the skies above their head or in control exit or entry into their so-called state, meaning it's not a state. I mean, if Australia didn't control entry and exit, it would not be a sovereign state. If the minerals under Australian soil were controlled by another power, it would not be a sovereign state. That's what Trump, Kushner, Netanyahu et al. Are offering. And by making that clear, which in fact was pretty much undergirding everything that President Carter, President Clinton, President Bush, all previous American presidents said, but said surreptitiously, I think he's made it clear that this was a sham all along, that nobody really intended to give the Palestinians anything approaching justice and equality or standing among the world of nations similar to any normal sovereign state. So there never really was, it turns out, a two-state solution, and Trump has made that clearer, I think, than ever before.
You are no admirer of the Palestinian Authority. Tell us why.
Well, many reasons. I mean, I think that the book details a number of failures going right back to the 20s and 30s of Palestinian leaderships, most recently of the Palestinian Authority. And I think that the root of the problem goes back to the period starting with the first Intifada in 1987, when the PLO tried to cash in on one of the greater successes of the Palestinian national movement. When the first Intifada showed that it was impossible to continue to rule the occupied territories through force, as Israel had been trying to do, and tried to parlay that into a deal at Oslo, which turned out to be an extremely bad deal. I was involved in negotiations prior to Oslo, and the things that the Israelis were offering us were completely unacceptable to anybody, in my view, with any self-respect, because there was no possibility of what Israel was offering leading to statehood, sovereignty, and so forth. They accepted those limitations, thinking that somehow they could wiggle their way out of it. Arafat and his colleagues accepted this. And this was the grave, grave mistake. There are many others, but I think this is, if you want, the original sin from which much else in terms of the problems that the Palestinians face has flowed.
Rashid, what are the options now?
Well, I think the Palestinians have to recognize that the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Palestine National Authority, notwithstanding, they haven't liberated anything. And they have to go back on a different footing. Instead of pretending that they're a state and that pretending they're a state will make them lead to their having a state, they have to figure out how they're going to get either to a state, in other words, reverse these processes that I think are irreversible, or come up with a strategy for something different, based on some form of equality and justice as between the two peoples. Because now there are two peoples. What started as a settler colonialist movement, as in Australia and the United States, is now a nation state, Israel. And the Palestinians, are going to have to figure out how to deal with that state, either by figuring out how to create a new state. And that means completely changing your mindset, mobilizing your people in a way that really hasn't been done since the first Intifada back in the late 1980s and early 1990s. It means adopting tactics that will appeal to some people in Israel, showing them that there's some kind of future that the Palestinians project that they, as Israelis, can live with. Putting forward something that talks about completely equal rights for everybody, equal national rights, equal religious rights. Today, Jews have rights in Israel that Palestinian citizens of Israel do not have. And Israeli citizens have rights that no Palestinians under occupation have at all. They have no rights at all, in fact. They control nothing in terms of the important things that relate to their lives. And the Palestinians have to, I think, put forward a vision, mobilize themselves. You could say a strategy or a vision and appeal to the world in a way that the PLO at its heyday was very successful in doing. I think that the point of BDS, the point of sanctions, is that it has been an enormously successful tactic throughout history. The Irish started it. Boycott is named for Captain Boycott, a land agent of a British lord who the Irish peasantry boycotted. And it was very successful in Ireland. It was successful in India, successful in South Africa. It was successful in the American South. It was the central tactic of the civil rights movement. And I think that it is one of many tactics that I think the Palestinians should adopt as a means of forcing their case on the world, on world opinion, showing that they are capable of pushing back at a situation where right now they're entirely on the defensive.
So the prospect of creating a democratic, sovereign, binational state in all of Palestine with rights for all, is it remotely feasible?
Well, I don't think any positive outcome at this moment is feasible. Rolling back everything that Israel has done over 53 years to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state is at this moment not feasible. Creating a binational state in which both peoples share in equality, rights and privileges and responsibilities is also not feasible. But the current situation is not sustainable. It is unstable. It involves a great deal of potential for violence, and it is monumentally unjust. So something has to be done, and movement towards a just solution is absolutely necessary. I mean, I think this is a moral question for the world. The League of Nations helped to create this. Great Britain helped to create this situation. The United Nations helped to create this situation, and the United States has perpetuated it. It is a responsibility of the world. It's, of course, a responsibility of the Palestinians, other Arabs, the Israelis, and others, Europe, certainly. But I think that bringing their case forcefully to the world, Israel is a powerful nation state. It's a nuclear power. But it is extraordinarily dependent on the outside world. It has some of the links that any colony has with a metropole. The difference between it and a standard colony is that it is now a nation state, of course, separate, independent nation state. And it has had in the past multiple metropoles. It is linked to Europe. It is linked to the United States. You change the situation in the United States and change the situation in Europe, and the Israelis have to change their situation, their position. They have to. They have no choice. That's not an easy thing to do, obviously. I live in the United States. I know how hard it is to change American public opinion, and especially the American political elite, which is very, very committed to a pro-Israeli position. But change, positive change, is taking place on multiple levels in the United States.
Now, I'm saying if Trump loses, any hope of change under President Biden?
Well, the hope for change is this. The Democratic Party is the majority party in the United States. The Republican Party has turned itself into a party of white, less educated, older people in the South and the West and a few other regions of the United States. It's become a regional party and a party of a distinct minority, and that minority is shrinking as the demographics of the United States change. The Democrats got 10 million more votes in the 2018 midterm congressional elections than did the Republicans. So they're the majority party. The base of the Democratic Party is changing rapidly. Now, we didn't see that in the Democratic National Committee's platform meetings over the platform of the party for the 2020 elections, unfortunately, because the old guard, the people who dominate the party, prevented positive change. There are minor changes made, but issues relating to occupation, issues relating to making aid to Israel conditional on ceasing human rights abuses, those planks could not be included. But the majority of the party, according to all the polling, the Pew Research Center and many other polls, the majority of the Democratic Party is increasingly sympathetic to the Palestinians. It is increasingly critical of Israel. And there are more and more members of Congress and a few senators, including several who look to be elected in 2020. I mean, in New York State, two very pro-Israel members of Congress have been replaced as the Democratic candidates, Nita Lowey in Westchester and Elliot Engel, by progressive pro-Palestine candidates. And those are districts that are Democratic. The same thing has happened here in Chicago. I'm currently in Chicago. I live in New York, but I'm currently in Chicago with a district held by a man named Lipinski, very pro-Israel. He's been replaced by a woman named Marie Newman, who is very pro-Palestinian. So Congress is shifting. Public opinion is shifting in the Democratic Party. I think there, and in what's happening on college campuses, there's a great deal of hope.
Rashid, I thank you very much for that. It's been a fascinating encounter. Rashid Khalidi's latest book is The 100 Years' War, and it's published now by Allen & Unwin. And we'll stay in touch, Rashid, and monitor developments. Thanks for your time.
I very much look forward to that.